Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's Handy Link. You're listening to Handy Link on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
Welcome to Handy Link, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that provides recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. For more information, check out ICHA on Facebook. I'm your host, Cam Wells.
In this segment of our show, Maria Guadagnoli will be telling us a little bit about her latest advocacy efforts.
So, can you tell me a little bit about your latest advocacy and research?
Yes, actually, a colleague of mine, Nancy LaMonica, and I presented at the Call Ontarios. We were talking a lot about universal design and some of the challenges of making a fully implementing a full universal design approach to learning. And it was actually quite fantastic because we were talking things about, like, you know, how the current education system is set up, especially around, like, flexibility and deadlines, as well as, you know, accommodating not just students but also professionals, and in this case, instructors and professors.
So, in that sense, what are some of the key challenges for a student with a disability as far as curriculum design?
So, one of the biggest challenges that we was with our own personal experiences, and Nancy LaMonica teaches specific courses on universal design, and a lot of the courses I teach around health, illness, and disability, is that, you know, the lack of flexibility, and some of it is unfortunately systemic because of the way the institutions are set up. You know, there's these deadlines, they're hard stops, and you, after this date, it's a zero ultimately, right? So the one biggest thing is having that flexibility. So how do we create an environment where things are flexible, gives students that ability to be self-expressed in what works and doesn't work with them without being constrained by these deadlines that are literally suffocating us, right? They have us they have us tied. And so one of the biggest things that students want is to be able to have the flexible deadlines. But then, you know, because of the way our system set up, it's capitalist, it's profit driven, and et cetera, it actually really makes it difficult to be able to really provide a true universal design of learning approach for students and faculty ultimately, right?
So, go ahead.
Go ahead. If you wanted to ask a question, there's lots to talk about on this topic.
Sure. I was just wondering, why do you think it is that institutions should make it a priority to provide a level playing field and some flexibility for students with disabilities as well as faculty?
Well, first off, if we want to get into a more, you know, intersectional and positionality approach to teaching and learning, we need to start considering all the different factors that will impact and or influencing people's access to education. If we don't start looking at those things and taking them in consideration, we're going to continue having a system that continues to socially exclude individuals that are continuously marginalized, not just individuals with disabilities, anybody based on sexual orientation, race, class, etc. So we need to start looking at ways to make this more accessible for all individuals, and that's where a universal design of learning, UDL, ultimately would help facilitate that. But the only way to do that is you need to have a major overhaul of the system, because the system itself is not designed to make everybody win. It's actually designed to make some or others.
So, do you have any advice you could offer as far as providing self-advocacy, steps students and faculty can take to say, hey, my rights need to be respected?
So one of the things I do recommend for students, actually, as a faculty, what I and I know Nancy both do, is we actually provide deadlines. And there's actually a literature on this, which at the moment I cover.
I'm getting some static here.
Oh, sorry. I was saying I can't remember the names of some of the literature that was shared with us from a couple of colleagues. But ultimately, making an approach where that success, offering students to start creating their own deadlines and schedules based on what works and doesn't work for them. It's also really important that educators create options for students. So, for example, if there's, rather than having an essay all the time for an assignment, looking at more, are there alternatives? So one thing I do in my course is I provide a portfolio opportunity where they'll still be doing writing, some writing assignments, but it offers some flexibility and diversity in the types of activities that can still demonstrate competency, learning, and skills to pass traditional essay. So example, in the portfolio, one of the weeks, when we touch upon mental health and addiction, I'm going to have students create a visual, however they choose, and then it's flexible. We're going to find a different word that they associate with mental health and addiction and create a visual with that. It can be typed, PowerPoint, it can be hand-drawn, whatever it looks like. And then they're going to describe and discuss what they created and why they created it. In doing that, it's fostering critical thinking, it's fostering making connections to larger social justice issues, and it's also looking at, with this stuff, what is maybe missing or what is something lacking. And it's all at the same time, there's a hands-on experiential approach to actually learning about a topic and the information that we'll be covering that week. So that is something that I know, there's more post-secondary educators and even elementary school educators and high schoolers educators that are starting to look more into that, but actually starting to move away from that formal teaching and learning. And one of the things that I really do believe in alternative teaching system, where there are alternative schools, teaching and learning schools that work and develop based on where the learner is.
So,
once again, within the current system, it's a bit problematic, but that's a whole different conversation.
So, one thing I've always found about students with disabilities, you find something that plays to their skills. If you give them an opportunity to actually use the areas that they're good at, they'll come out with a result that matches the requirements or exceeds them in many cases. But
yes,
it's just more a matter of something geared towards them.
Yes.
I'm taking it that a student would still be asked to achieve to the same level regardless of the disability. Just the mannerisms of getting there might be a little modified in some ways.
Exactly, exactly. And there are options of providing, for example, instead of doing like a formal written essay, they can orally present their thoughts, right? They can do maybe, they call them like digital stories, a recording. There's ways to achieve the same outcome without having to go by the narrow, limiting ways that education has been provided in the past.
Like, thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Awesome, yes, I definitely will. Thank you, Cam.
Of course. This segment of our show
Taya Aguias will be giving us an update on her accessible dance work. So, can you tell me a little bit about your latest adaptive work?
Sure. So, Sunshine Dance Studios lately has been expanding into a couple classes. We have two new classes that I'm very excited about with a new group. Windsor Essex Community Living is doing a dance class. I'm doing a dance class with them, and that one's super fun. And then I also have another dance class with Up About Down, which I already dance with them. But this time we're doing a dance with participation. So that class has to be a little bit different than our normal dance classes. So we're doing line dancing, which is super fun. We have cowboy hats, and we're learning all of the fun line dances that are popular and not so popular.
So, in teaching someone with, say, Down syndrome to learn the dance steps, do you use any modified teaching techniques?
So, a lot of our modifications come with just making sure that the dancer is comfortable with what they're moving and how they're moving. The new dance class that I had yesterday, it was our first dance class, and it was all online, which makes it a little bit harder to adapt, using like adaptive methods to make it maybe easier or a little bit less challenging. So I just make sure to communicate with the dancers that I want to make sure that they're doing it to the best of their ability to really challenge themselves, but not to the point where they're hurting themselves or where they're unable to do it. So the ways that I like to adapt our dance moves is by saying, taking a deep breath and really feeling into your body. So if your legs may be hurting, then we'll use more arms. Or if our arms are maybe a little bit sore, then we'll use more legs. So really just doing what feels right for them. Another way I'd say that I adapt is by giving them the autonomy to really make up their own dance moves too. So if they're really not feeling what I'm giving them, the choreography that I'm providing, and they just want to do something totally left field, they have the stage to do that. I think dance with Sunshine Dance Studios at least is about moving and about exercise, but at the same time it's really about expressing yourself. So whichever ways that they want to adapt to make it easier or to make it more challenging or to really express themselves, it's all open and up to them.
So, do you have any advice for the dance classes as to what they can do between sessions to sort of keep themselves moving and ready for the next class?
That's a great question. I think stretching is a really big part of, keeping limber. So stretching maybe once a day for even 5 to 10 minutes, touching your toes, stretching your arms, your ankles, and your wrists. Those are kind of the main joints that I think I use, at least in my dance classes. And there's lots of jumping, so stretching your thighs and your hamstrings and your calves and your ankles, using your arms, stretching those kind of side to side, maybe over your head, touching the back of your neck, that kind of stuff. Also just keeping active in whatever way that you can. So maybe going for a walk or going for a light run, if that is something that you're able to do. And if not, then just kind of practicing maybe some dance moves that you really like that we'll go over in the next class. So like I said, we do a lot of jumping, but if maybe someone's in a wheelchair and they're not able to jump, then maybe practicing something that is similar to jumping, like moving your shoulders up and down, kind of the same as like a jumping motion, and practicing those dance moves to get stronger, because we do them often in a lot of our dance classes.
So what are some of the key benefits of dance and movement for someone with a disability?
That's another great question. I think the main benefit there's lots of main benefits, actually. I take from it. There's not just one main one. I really like the community aspect of a dance class that we provide. Sunshine Dance Studios is very community-oriented, right? So I like having lots of people making new friends and making new connections with people that they've never met before. But within your actual physical body, I think It's a really good tool to improve your fine motor skills. Doing things that is precise kind of helps grow those skills a little bit more. It helps your flexibility when we're stretching or when we're dancing. It helps just to keep active and to keep your heart healthy. And it's also a great stress reliever, and it really boosts your endorphins. So anytime that you're moving, your happy hormones are kind of being let out. So anytime that I dance, if I'm in a grumpy mood and then I dance, whether it's by myself or with my group or with anybody, just with my friends, I always feel 10 times better at the end of like a little dance session because of all the endorphins that are being released.
So I'd imagine that would have the effect of sort of loosening up the muscles as well. Where the mind goes, the body will follow, sort of thing.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Our dance classes are typically pretty like exercise based. So like I said, we do a lot of, it's definitely set choreography, but we also include a lot of exercise movements, like maybe jumping jacks or jumps or touching your toes, that kind of stuff. But there's definitely, and I would love to experiment with this with my group in the future, but doing more like adaptive dance. So doing slow dance moves if you're feeling maybe a little bit sadder that day, or doing really fun, high energy dance moves to feel really happy. And exactly what you said, where your mind goes, your body will kind of follow. And I think that's important, and it really helps to let go of any like tension or stress that you hold in your mind, to just let it flow through the body.
So what are the next steps forward in your work?
I would love to keep continuing adding more dance classes. So anybody that would like to dance with me, let me know. Visit our website. And I love making partnerships. So I would love to, within the next couple months, next couple years, make a lot of community partnerships and relationships. And I think that that's important, not only to get the word out and to expand dance classes, but I think it's really important also to make those relationships, to break stigmas and to really show the world that disability and dance can go hand in hand, and it doesn't have to be completely separate. And everyone has their own autonomy to kind of choose what they want to do, whether that is dance or any activity, that they're not limited to their disability.
Like, thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you could stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Of course.
HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
Think you've heard it all? Think again. Indian beatmaster Ritesh Das brings you the latest sound exploration with Japanese taiko, Macedonian folk, and Canadian rock icon Biff Naked. You've got to hear it to believe it. Juno-nominated Toronto Tabla Ensemble's new album, For the Love of Tabla, is out now.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that provides recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. For more information, check out ICHA on Facebook. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, Maria Guadagnoli told us a little bit about her latest efforts concerning disability education, and we heard from Disabilities dance instructor Taya Aguias. In this segment of our show, we'll be chatting with Katie Tenacia from Picking Up the Pieces. So, can you tell me a little bit about Picking Up the Pieces?
Certainly I can. So, Picking Up the Pieces was formed in 2008 after my husband, who was part of our national police force, deployed overseas in a peacekeeping mission. And it probably wasn't as peaceful as it could have been. And consequently, he came home quite shattered. And a little bit different to how he sort of took off on the adventure. So took a couple of weeks before we realised what was actually really going on, and then found out that he was suffering with chronic post-traumatic stress disorder. And so that was the catalyst, I guess, back then, all that time away, was a catalyst to think, well, you know, we always associate post-traumatic stress with our military, but not so much anywhere else, especially back then. We've come a long way in those years. But I guess from our perspective as a family, you know, we were a young family at that time. It was very quite confronting and quite isolating. So we figured that we needed to really bring more awareness around something that was actually impacting not only sort of our military, but also our first responders significantly and our general community. So, yeah, so we founded Picking Up the Pieces in 2008, and only in just during COVID we've branched out on our own and turned it into a fully registered sort of charity now, where we were auspiced under another organisation. So, yeah, so we're sort of going great guns now, but not without its trials and triumphs, I would say.
So how do you go about reaching out to the affected community to let them know there is support for those suffering from PTSD?
Yeah, it's a bit of a tough one, because especially with our first responder community, or our front line. I know here in Australia we have been impacted, you may have heard, we've been impacted by significant drought, and then it was floods. Everyone suffered through a pandemic. So reaching out, we're lucky that our government has seen a need. So there's actually quite a lot of resources for people to actually seek assistance. The biggest issue that we have is that in doing so, there comes a stigma with that. We'd like to think that we've come a long way, but especially within a uniformed service culture, it can actually end your career if you come forward with a sort of psychological injury. And so we're finding it a lot harder to get our sort of members to come forward, because they have so much fear in losing their careers. So, but most of the organisations and first responder organisations have quite good peer support networks and quite good in-house systems, but it's very it can be quite tricky. So yeah, and I always, before I do a radio interview like this, because I've done quite a few now, I always usually will put a trigger warning up, sort of saying that you know, anybody that is listening to this, be mindful, have your supports around you, because we might talk about something that could bring up some, you know, internalise some thoughts and sort of make people feel a bit uncomfortable. And so I always put out a trigger warning, so I thought I probably should do that.
So do you think the hesitation about coming forward that someone is affected comes from any myths or stereotypes about PTSD?
Oh, absolutely. There's massive stereotypes that, and I guess we've even actually experienced it firsthand, where there's a stereotype that people with post-traumatic stress, and we tend to call it an injury, not so much of a disorder. I know in the DSM-5 it's disorder, and that's the way it is, but it is initially an injury. We have really faced some incredible stigma and some incredible, have been made feel just at times, not all the times, and it's a lot better, but sometimes, especially early on, you know, you just sort of feel like you're a tainted being, or you've become sort of, you know, very, very tainted, and they, because of the stereotyping around post-trauma, that people can be dangerous or predictable and violent and all of these things, that sort of, you know, can really sort of have a huge impact on people wanting to step forward. And if we can sort of beat that stigma down a little, that would be absolutely fantastic.
So if you could send any message to the community about the need to be understanding and to keep an open mind surrounding these issues. What would you say?
This is sort of my life's work, to be really honest. I'm very passionate about mental health education, huge, and preventative mental health education. It's probably, you know, that's my life's work. And I've actually been to Canada quite a few times and spoken at quite a few of your congresses and sort of conferences on this very subject matter, because we want people to be able to come forward. It's like any other injury. So if you if you took a fall down the steps and broke your foot, you're not going to wait 6 months or 12 months before you go and get that looked at, because by then it's going to be a really nasty injury. It's going to be just harder to fix. And, you know, so with mental health, this is exactly the same thing. So with part of our education model, which has been exceedingly successful in this country, is sort of getting in really early. So the message is, if you have been through a traumatic experience, and then everyone's going to have some sort of reaction, and that's very normal. But it's knowing the difference between what is a normal reaction to a traumatic exposure and what is not. And so once those symptoms start encroaching for a longer period of time, people will experience sort of lack of sleep, they can be startled, they can start to sort of really have a lot of anxiety, irritability, there can be some guilt, people might even turn to substance abuse, and then you sort of go through this helplessness and hopelessness. And if we can actually, my message is, if we can get people who we know that's been exposed, so if you look at all of our first responders, especially our first responders dealing with COVID, I'm sure that COVID in Canada is exactly the same and having the same impact on your healthcare system as it is on ours. Yeah, it's frightening. And I worry for... I wrote an article in 2020 predicting that there would be a massive fallout for our frontline first responders in terms of our doctors, nurses, anybody sort of really in that first line, paramedics in particular, and also their children. I often worry about the children of our first responders, because they were the ones going off to work. Our children were sort of kept home from school because of isolation. And so when they went to work, we've got this sort of cohort of children between a certain age that are going to be fearful, because it was like, oh, mum or dad, or sometimes you will find that there can be a family where there's two first responders, and it's like they're going to go off to work. And the media, I know with our media, it's died down a lot now, but initially when COVID first came, it was just on everything. It was everywhere. And it was like how dangerous it was. And it was really, there was a lot of death occurring. And so these are kids watching their parents go off to work, wondering if they're going to get COVID, bring it home. And so they stay in this heightened state of arousal for a very, very long time. And so not only are the parents going to be feeling it, but their children as well. And I'm sort of very passionate about that, because if we bring preventative mental health education in now on what are the signs, symptoms, and really educate our communities as a whole, sort of like through various different methods, then I think we can reduce the impact of mental health. But I can see a massive tsunami and a massive wave of mental health conditions, and without a doubt our suicide rate is already going up in this country. I imagine that Canada would be the same.
Like, thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Absolutely, yeah.
My friends, where does it come from? Where does the idea that it's okay to build walls and stigmas around mental health concerns come from? We can find it so easy to have compassion for someone in a wheelchair, or has a vision impairment, or a hearing impairment. What makes us think that a mental health concern such as PTSD is any less valid? It's affecting a person's life. It's not something they asked for. It is not something they can control easily. Why is it we think it's okay to build up these clouds of confusion simply because we don't understand it yet? You know how you get to understanding it? You ask questions, share time with the person, maybe even lending a hand in support. You're not going to grow in your own understanding unless you take those steps forward. And you can do it. These people are worth getting to know, as we all are. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal. So get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.